Many years ago, I had an astrological reading done for myself. David had a reading done. We're not people who understand astrology enough to really follow it or have ever felt inclined to study it. But from time to time, for one reason or another, I've thought we've sought the perspective that a person who can read the horoscope would give us. And the astrologer said in that particular reading, he talked about David's, just his chart, and it talked about the most auspicious period of his life was from birth to 18 years old. And then the astrologer said, too bad. It was wasted. It was wasted in childhood. And then in some conversation later with Swamiji, we were, because Swamiji always has an interest in anything that's an expanded reality, that's beyond the mundane. He's always interested in anyone with psychic, not anyone, but many people with psychic abilities or the power of crystals or the effectiveness of astrology or the ancient book of Bhrigu in India. He's always just very open-minded about manifestations of a higher consciousness, no matter, and a different consciousness than just the rational. So we were discussing with him just the various things that he said, and I quoted, without really thinking, too bad, it was wasted. Swamiji's response was extremely interesting. Oh no, he said, that was extremely fortunate, because therefore what happens if you're born in an auspicious astrological period, or however you want to put it, is that from the beginning of your life, your expectation is always positive. Things will work out. Blessings come. I can be confident. I can function in this world. Whatever the ideas might be, you get oriented. And the way that we're oriented becomes our magnetism. And then our magnetism determines our karma after that. Now, I'm not saying all of this because this sermon is not really about him particularly. But when I was trying to find... Sorry. Everything I do is really about David, but this is going to be one of the under ones where it doesn't show. But I was trying to think about this reading today because we find it so difficult to get our mind around this fact. I mean, in anything other than a very distant theoretical way. Oh yes, we're all children of the divine. And then we go on, just exactly as Swami describes, to then chronicle ourselves in terms of, you know, that I have this problem and I have that problem and someday I'll realize this and this is what I don't understand or the astrology I'm having. As I said last summer, my moon went into Hades as far as I was concerned. And it just hung out there for like months. And I could feel it. It was like always hovering, just getting ready to try to torture me. You know, we have one reason or another why, even though we are children of the divine, not today, not tomorrow, not really until this 12-year cycle is over. And I mean, we're all in this together. It's just the way the mind works, that we constantly go back to the reasons why the highest truth isn't really true, even though if you ask, we'll answer. We believe it. We have faith in it. But on a real deep level, we don't. I remember Devi talking about when she, for a period of time, she was part of one of the long training courses at Ananda Village. She would teach one of the long training courses. It was probably a teacher training course of some kind. But the main thing was she spent 4 weeks teaching this one group of people. And they all, of course, got to know each other really well. And it was a mandated course with a lot of curriculum. And she explained her own evolution leading that course was that at the beginning, she thought she had this serious obligation to teach people this information from this book and these understandings and these principles. And yes, of course, why not? A lot of those ideas are very helpful to us. But they're helpful to us, as she put it, because they help us root out the only problem that we really have, which is that we don't know who we are. And as a consequence, the default setting for our minds is toward our limitations, is toward the reasons why we can't really be happy yet, is toward all the issues that are behind it. And so when Swami Kriyananda, as was his habit for many years, whenever he would see any of us, his greeting would be, and not in a casual way, "Good morning, great souls," he would say. And you would look to see who'd come in the room with you. You know, like, who could he possibly be talking to? And then you realize that you're the only one standing there. He must be talking to me. And, you know, it was sweet and it was slightly humorous. And it for a long time, it was kind of what you would call, was part of the Ananda culture to refer to one another as great souls. But it was there was quite a serious intent behind it. Because the odd thing about the spiritual path altogether, which again, because we are trapped in a rational habit, and because we are held by the delusion of time, and we are convinced by the presence of the material world and the presence of our material bodies that these are really what's going on, and only occasionally does that crack. So that, and let's see, with all those conditions, I forgot what the point was. So I will find the point. But the point had to do with, oh yes, I know what it is, is that we're always pushing by our own actions the real solution to our problems, which is to just be who we really are. So even in the Gita commentary, the Gita verse today, those who seek God with wisdom find him, but those who seek God with impure motive, that's what they actually said, then they never find him. Now, that's a real sort of scary thing to parse apart, because we all certainly feel sincere in our desire to know God. I think that sincerity is the salient quality of people who come onto this path or even come into this temple. I often joke, and to me this is a great virtue, about the Ananda Temple of Self-Realization of Palo Alto sitting right here. There's absolutely no peripheral benefit to coming here. You know, it just gives you no status. The chance of your action, well, you might find a romantic partner, but even that, our percentages are not really high, but you know, we've had a few lucky meetings here. There's no business contacts. There's no network here. It is nothing. Which I hope forever it stays like that. The only reason that you would come here is if sincerely somehow the presence of the masters, the spirit of God in the way it plays through this reality, speaks to your own heart. So the sincerity of anyone that I would be speaking to in this context, to me, is the given. And I presume that you all can feel that in your own selves. So we are deeply sincere. So what is the confusion? Why is this so hard? Why is it that emotional misunderstandings sweep in, and self-doubts sweep in, and good intentions get all garbled up in wrong execution? And I don't have a really good answer for that. And then here the Gita makes it worse. If you seek God with right understanding, you'll find him, and if your motives are impure. But Swamiji couples this with Jesus saying, "Blessed are the pure in heart." And he couples this with Jesus' firm statement that no one ascends to heaven who didn't come from heaven. And then elsewhere, and it's an important adjunct to that, he promises us that that's where we're all going. That, you know, that which I do, ye shall do, and greater things. Why do you call me great? Does not your scripture say that all of you are gods? The kingdom of God is within. Why do you seek, he says, here and lo there? That's how he puts it. You have this picture of all these people looking for the kingdom of God, you know, pulling up the carpet. It's like, where is it? It's within us. And he doesn't say it's within some of us. It's within all of us. And of course, self-realization makes that, that's the whole premise of self-realization, is that God dwells within us, and all we have to do is improve our knowing. Even that word realization, we just have to come to know that which was always true, that we never noticed. But we get into this very, very serious karmic habit for one reason or another, where every time we're about to lift our consciousness into that freedom, something else will come in the way and keep us from doing that. You know, this is the whole training, so to speak, for the hour of our death, which we don't know as a rule in this culture, spend a lot of time training for the hour of our death. And on a certain level, it seems like goofy. Why don't you have a life first? You know? But one never knows when the hour of death is coming. But let's think of it more seriously than that. It's not so much or only that we're training for the moment when we exit from this physical body and never come back to it, when this whole lila of whatever your name is in all its contexts is going to dissolve. But life is a series of never-ending deaths. And not death in the big one, but never-ending change. Isn't that so? We get ourselves comfortably ensconced in one place or another, and then something goes wrong. It just goes wrong, and then it goes wrong. One of the most, this is a poignant thing, and perhaps some of you have had to face this, I don't know, but there's certain kinds of mental illnesses that manifest in early adulthood or late teenage years. And every time I hear or read about one of those, somehow, I don't know why, maybe it's a memory of my own, but the poignancy of that seems especially acute to me. Because here we are, you know, we've raised the child to the point where he or she is beginning to stand on their own, and then all of a sudden this utterly life-changing reality that had always been a potentiality but just never came to the surface until then. I mean, it's just a very dramatic, heartbreaking form of the fact that everything is always changing. Life is a constant series of the death of one reality and the birth of a new reality. So when I say, let us prepare ourselves for the hour of our death, well, that was 5 minutes ago and after lunch. Even if we continue in this physical body, the degree to which we are unable to flow dynamically and ever expansively with in completely unreliable circumstances, that's the definition of why our happiness is limited, our stress is great, our potentials are semi-realized. And when Swamiji calls us great souls, we're startled for a moment. You know, preparing for the hour of death, and this is what I was going to say. Nowadays, because of the movies and because of the advanced medical procedures, which allow people to live through these heart-stopping, breath-stopping experiences and go all the way into the astral worlds and then come back. And really, because we're getting into a higher age in which all of these truths can be more explicitly understood, we have very, very interesting, true pictures of what that actual exit from the body is like. You know, that the tunnel of light appears and we start going down the tunnel of light. And as we start going down the tunnel of light, what also happens to us is that we realize that we are leaving behind, you know, our physical body, our name, our children, all the people that we love, our self-definition, our money, whatever it might be. People say that, even to this day, that there are spirits caught between the material and the astral world who died in the World Trade Center destructions. Because people were right in the middle of their commitment to this world, and boom, then they're in the astral world. They're looking, you know, they're looking for their money. They're looking for their cars. They're just looking for everything that was theirs just, you know, seconds before all of it was gone. Now, we certainly don't want to get caught between the worlds, you know, being so attached to the material world that you can't find the astral world. Again, we have television dramas and movies about all of this, so the great convenience for someone like me is I don't have to really explain all that, because you're all really elevated in your understanding, at least in a popular way. But you see, what's happening there is when that moment comes, and it's brought to us from the soul's reality. We live on two realities, the infinite part of ourself or the individual part of ourselves that goes to the infinite. It's actually the word for it is jiva or atman, the divine within. And that part inhabits this body, actually manifests this body, and then becomes identified with it. And so the extent to which we are defined by this changing self and all the things that are involved in it, its sense of doubt, its worldly attachments, its self-preoccupation, its aches and pains, its attachment to certain conditions and things. It's not that we can't or shouldn't live in those things. Those are also God-given. This is a very important fact. These are all God-given. These are all deliberately manifest by our own higher nature as an important part of our self-expansion. But the mistake we make is that we become identified with what we've manifested and we lose connection with the power that manifested it in the first place. And we lose connection with the reason why we manifested it, and we begin to think it's an end in itself. And then sooner or later, whether it's by government fiat or personal interactions or illness or the approaching age or the final one, which is where the individual bubble is just pulled out completely, you know, whichever, wherever that is, sooner or later, if we have identified and defined ourselves with anything other than the pure light of God that's in us, we're going to have to go through these issues. And those issues are either going to be, well, what they usually are is we get insecure because it's not the way it's supposed to be. This is where Swami comes back and says, you know, if you're in a very auspicious 18-year astrological cycle, then the flow of energy works. And you get this idea that I can deal with things, I can make things happen, and it identifies you more with that positive flow of energy than with the thwarting cross currents. But that's a choice. It's helpful. You know, we all have good and bad astrological periods. When my moon went into Hades last summer, it was extremely interesting for me because, fortunately, and I say this with some sense of self-satisfaction. I won't quite use the word proud, but it was very satisfying for me to observe the fact that I could tell the difference between the influence of my moon in Hades and me. And it was like I was walking around all this time, and then there was this little aura around me that kept trying to persuade me to suffer. And it was just always trying to persuade me to suffer. You know, telling me that there were all these things wrong and that I, you know, non-specific. It was just more a vibration. Most of the time, we get upset first and then we find a reason, right? Or something happens and it's a choice is what I'm trying to say. Yogananda says conditions are always neutral. Of course, we're highly biased to perceive them as happy or unhappy. But it's a very important metaphysical truth that conditions are always neutral, and how we experience them depends on the orientation of our mind and our feelings and our consciousness. So it was fun for me to see that there was this enormous force trying to tell me to be upset, and for some reason, which I would only call the grace of God, I didn't believe it. But I watched it. And it was sort of like having coffee stain on my clothes all the time, you know? It's like there was something always a little off, but it wasn't about me. It was just the field I was in. Yogananda himself, speaking of astrology and autobiography of a yogi, he says, he confirms that this is an interrelated universe, and even that which seems distant, everything is interrelated, and there's no coincidence or accidents. This universe is conscious. There's this enormous, it's all manifested from consciousness. There's no point where there's not consciousness. So we can't just dismiss things that might even seem at first glance, you know, to have no basis in reason. Now he's talking about astrology. How can a planet that we can't even see actually determine my fate? But that's a whole different discussion here. But Yogananda Master said that it was a true force, but then he said, but the human will is greater. And he said sometimes, and this Swami told us this, sometimes he would deliberately find out the most inauspicious time to do something and then would set forward and be successful. And then, but he admitted it took a lot more willpower to do it then than if the forces of the universe had been cooperating with me. But the human will is always stronger because we are divine in our nature. We descend from heaven. We are connected to infinite power. We are by our nature divine bliss, but we have identified with this limited reality. And the impure motive that the Gita attributes to us as the block between ourselves and the perception of God is not evil. You know, it's not like I want to realize God so I can lord it over all my friends or anything like that. That's not what we're talking about. But the impure motive is that we're still hoping that we can bring God into our little universe and that he will just confirm all of our desires here. I was thinking the other day that often what we seek in life is not personal perfection or even personal excellence. All we want to be is successful. Do you see the difference? We want to be successful. We want to get what we want. We want to be recognized in certain ways. We're not actually deep within ourselves clear enough to say, no, what I want to be is be therefore perfect. What I want to do is to be pure in my heart, pure in my motives, true in my love for people, you know, honest in my self-understanding. We're often much more interested in the results and how it looks than we are in actually really coming, purging ourselves of all of our wrong thinking. Now, the irony of it is just overwhelming to me. When I was reflecting on this reading and just thinking, where do we even start? The irony is, everything we want, we already have. Everything we hope to be, we already are. Every concept of beauty and wonderfulness and everything else is our true nature. And what we fight for is the opposite of that. And what we protect is everything we don't want. How do you begin to unravel it? Where do you even start? I remember Richard Bach, who was he's the author and well-known, and he is very good at the clever phrase. He said, if you want to fight to hold on to your limitations, here's the reward for that. You get to keep them, right? You know, if we fight to hold on to our limited consciousness, we get to keep it. We operate on so many different levels at the same time. And that's part of what makes it hard. But what makes it simple is the answers that the masters give us. Love God, love God, love God. And we somehow don't understand that even the quality of the mind comes from the quality of the heart. The disturbances of the mind come from the quality of the heart. I was engaged in the last few days in a few email exchanges on some very complicated issues, and it was so amazing to me to see how I read the email first, and then second, and then third. You know, first, I was engaged in a point of view and a commitment and a feeling about it, and the words said a certain something to me. The next morning, after a little more calm meditation, a little more reflection on it, a little more expansion of how we all really love each other and all mean well, the very words on the page said something else to me. You know, it wasn't the words on the page. Well, it was the impure motive. Am I trying to get all the world to line up in support of the point of view I already have? Or do I really want to know? Every week we go through the Festival of Light and we have the story of the bird, little bird who's manifested in all the problems he goes through. And when our services run a little too long, we do the redacted version of the Festival of Light. And the first thing we always throw out is the little bird, Because people get a little tired of hearing about the little bird sometimes. Yeah, we know what's going to happen. He's going to go through these stages. He's finally going to work it out. You know, maybe we can have a new story sometimes. But the irony of it is, almost always when I quote from the Festival of Light, or the most important times I use the Festival of Light as an example, it's always that darn little bird. Because here's what that little bird does. He's manifested out of the pure power of the Spirit, and God says, have a great time. You're part of me. Just go out there and be part of me. And the bird rushes out to do that. But then it begins to flex its own wings. And it begins to think, you know, I'm not really so sure. And it begins to sort of build up its own concept. It becomes a little impure in its motives, right? And that stage is called the revolt, which is an extremely interesting word. It's like reality is a certain way, but I think I'll just rebel against what is and try to make it work according to something that isn't actually there, which is that my self-concept and my ego and my desire to have things a certain way, that's what truth is. And then the little story goes, and then the bird gets crushed and crushed and kicked and crushed and crushed and crushed and crushed and crushed. And finally the bird says, oh, gee, maybe I'm doing something wrong. And that becomes the quest. The bird's not really any smarter, except the bird has figured out that maybe I don't know. So he's not wise, but his motives have become more pure. He's not trying so hard to just force the universe into his mold. Now he's on a quest. Oh, what is true here? What really is, what's really happening? That's the purity of motive that we need. Because we can't be any more wise than we are, but we can be humble enough to not try to protect, but genuinely want to know. And that's the stages that we go through. And once we're there, you know, we still mess up. People often ask, you know, what do you do in your Ananda community when you have disagreements? What is your system for solving conflicts? What is your crisis resolution? You know, all these. And for years we would say, we don't really have any systems because we don't really have that kind of problem. And then they would just assume that we were just idiots or something. Or all under the thumb of Swami Kriyananda, especially in the early years. He just tells you what to do. And I was in a situation where I was always having to defend against whether Swamiji was this oppressive dictatorial leader. And finally, I just began to laugh. Instead of taking it so seriously, I began to laugh. I said, just come to any Ananda meeting. You know, I would love a little mindless cooperation sometimes. You know, it would be a relief. You know, it's just not the way we are. You know, we're very, very, very strong-willed. Very strong-willed. Well, did I say that? Very strong-willed. I mean, I'm talking to you, you know. But underneath that is the quest, is the pure desire for truth. And once that's there, even if these things happen, even if you misread the email the first two or three times, by the end, no, no, no. My entire consciousness may not be free, but my motives are pure. And if they're not pure, I'm going to keep at them until they become so. Because when I no longer want anything but truth, and am willing to just let the rest of it go into that light and let the rest of it go, then we see God. As simple as that. That which is always there is suddenly perceivable by us. It always was there, but suddenly we're able to perceive it because all the shadows have been removed. It's not a process, seemingly, that happens like this or happens effortlessly. That's the confusion of it. But happen, indeed, it does. You know, anyone who has worked with this is in the Festival of Light, even a little practice of this inward religion will save you from dire fears and colossal sufferings. And a little bit of experience will prove to you that that is, in fact, true. What joy, what a blessing. God bless.